Welcome to The Bibliopod, Maclean's Magazine's book podcast for the weekend of June 26th. I'm Anne Kingston. My co-host Brian Bethune is on holiday. This week, I sit down with author Kevin Kwan, whose new novel, China Rich Girlfriend, a sequel to his bestseller, Crazy Rich Asians, explores and exposes the lives of the Chinese mega-rich. Before we get to that, though, I want to talk about another popular book, the 50 Shades of Grey sequel, Grey, 50 Shades of Grey, as told by Christian. The book dropped a week ago. As of Thursday morning, it has sold more than 1.1 million copies and is the fastest-selling adult title ever in the UK. That's not surprising. The first trilogy, a sex-stoked yet banal series of stories about the relationship between virgin Anastasia Steele and rich industrialist Christian Grey, has sold more than 12.5 million copies internationally. Predictably, there's much gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands about the new book, given the rabid opposition to 50 Shades of Grey's sexual politics, and the fact that author E.L. James has never been accused of being a prose stylist. The sequel has been trashed by critics. In her review in The Guardian, Jenny Colgan wrote that reading the book was a bit like peering into the inside of your dog's head. But here's the thing. Who doesn't want to peer into the inside of their dog's head? That question touches on why it was inevitable the sequel would be an out-of-the-gate blockbuster. The legion of die-hard 50 Shades of Grey fans want nothing more than to know what Christian Grey is thinking. After all, wondering, what is he thinking, is the eternal female time waster. E.L. James may not know how to write, but she knows what a lot of women want. And I say that as someone who hasn't read either book. I tried with the first one and I failed. And all I've read of the sequel is the sensational tidbits immediately posted online. But I do speak with some authority. Years ago, I worked part of my way through university copy editing Harlequin romance novels, all of which are modeled on Jane Eyre. And E.L. James has the Harlequin formula down pat. Young ingenue tames and wins heart of cold and distant man. Scanning the 10 hottest scenes from the book, it's clear that Christian's thinking, for the most part, isn't on S&M mastery, but rather totally focused on predictably, there's much gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands about the new book, given the rabid opposition to 50 Shades of Grey's sexual politics, and the fact that author E.L. James has never been accused of being a prose stylist. The sequel has been trashed by critics. In her review in The Guardian, Jenny Colgan wrote that reading the book was a bit like peering into the inside of your dog's head. But here's the thing. Who doesn't want to peer into the inside of their dog's head? That question touches on why it was inevitable the sequel would be an out-of-the-gate blockbuster. The legion of die-hard 50 Shades of Grey fans want nothing more than to know what Christian Grey is thinking. After all, wondering, what is he thinking, is the eternal female time waster. E.L. James may not know how to write, but she knows what a lot of women want. And I say that as someone who hasn't read either book. I tried with the first one and I failed. And all I've read of the sequel is the sensational tidbits immediately posted online. But I do speak with some authority. Years ago, I worked part of my way through university copy editing Harlequin romance novels, all of which are modeled on Jane Eyre. And E.L. James has the Harlequin formula down pat. Young ingenue tames and wins heart of cold and distant man. Scanning the 10 hottest scenes from the book, it's clear that Christian's thinking, for the most part, isn't on S&M mastery, but rather totally focused on pleasing a partner by whom he is thoroughly enraptured. It's a fantasy a lot of people want to buy into, precisely because it is a fantasy. So if a sequel told from Christian's point of view outsells the first trilogy, no one should be one bit surprised. Kevin Kwan's critically acclaimed novel, Crazy Rich Asians, published in 2013, introduced readers to a multi-generational, intermarried, mega-rich clan in Singapore coming together for Asia's over-the-top wedding of the year. It's a meticulously detailed portrait of an excessive alternative universe that's also wickedly funny. So was his recently published sequel, China Rich Girlfriend, which picks up the story 2 years later, adding some new characters as it shifts gears to include mind-boggling conspicuous consumption in China. Welcome to the Bibliopod, Kevin.
It's great to be here.
You grew up in Singapore in the wealthy milieu you write about. When did it dawn on you that the rising billionaire class of Asia would be rich fodder for fiction?
You know, it's interesting. Even as a little kid, I remember my grandmother, who was born in mainland China, telling me, she's like, just you watch. China, by the 21st century, is going to take over the world. And of course, when you're a kid, all you care about is Knight Rider, you know, and Battlestar Galactica and American shows, and you just can't fathom a world beyond, you know, the sort of the empire of America. And so I always took what she said with a grain of salt. But more and more these days, we're finding that China has sort of been, you know, rising. So maybe about 20 years ago, when I was first starting creative writing at University of Houston, did I really think, you know, there's something here that I need to keep watching, and there's stories brewing that I need to tell.
What were you observing back then?
Well, back then I was traveling. You know, I would go back on vacations to visit relatives and friends in places like Hong Kong, and just seeing how every time I would go back, it would become more and more surreal. And it was all revolving around the levels of wealth and how rich people were getting and how this was really affecting their lives, you know, not just in good ways, but also in the sort of very negative, dramatic, over-the-top, tragic, and to me kind of funny ways of what too much money does to you.
Well, there's something unique about the Chinese culture itself in terms of you have on one hand, and it's captured brilliantly in both books, this idea of the sort of 19th century Jane Austen concern with lineage and marrying daughters into good families, combined with, you know, the Tom Wolfe kind of Bonfire of the Vanities, combined with this ancient tradition of display and dynasty. And they kind of marry, and I'm wondering how you see the culture itself contributing to what is almost unbelievable excess.
That's such an interesting question, and I wish I could really kind of explain how I feel about it. But I think it's this kind of mess, this juxtaposition of the rich and poor and the extreme levels of wealth clashing with centuries-old traditions that I really wanted to look at. And there was no way to really organize it, so I just kind of let it rip, if you know what I mean, in these different characters. And I'm still trying to understand it myself, which I think is one of the reasons why I actually wrote these books. It's I wanted to try to get underneath the skin of this very unusual confluence of cultures and behaviors and situations that are happening in Asia right now.
Well, it's also very much a story, an intergenerational story, and a clash of generations and values, which is, you know, the sense of respect for elders and how that filters into behaviors as well. I'm wondering whether just even writing about this is in any way a clash for you.
It very much is, I think. Just sort of being able to see that and see how my family has evolved, you know, with so many people moving out of Asia and sort of, you know, the grand sort of diaspora of overseas Chinese and how they've adapted to new cultures. And yet they are still beholden in many ways to this ancient tradition of being Chinese, and how the mainland Chinese now, the China rich, don't have any of those baggages. You know, the slate was wiped clean for them when Mao, you know, during the Cultural Revolution, just sort of extinguished all the sense of tradition, all the religion, everything. And so you see this bizarre new culture that is Chinese, but doesn't even know about these Chinese traditions that have existed for centuries.
Well, that's very much a subject of China Rich Girlfriend. And there's a wonderful character in the book. Her name's Corina Ko-Tung, who charges a ton of money to consult with the nouveau riche in terms of in mainland China and how to be accepted by old money. And it's just wickedly chronicled. It's like a taxonomy of what you need to do to be accepted. In fact, how you can alter your behavior to be accepted by the upper crust old guard. I'm curious. I mean, you are so acutely aware of all of these details which are chronicled. Living in New York as you do, how do you stay abreast of the kind of the nuances, all of the social signifiers? And they are down to the, you know, nail polish, down to watches, down to everything. You're just on top of it.
I always say once an Asian, always an Asian. So even though I've lived in New York for 20 years, I can't get away from these people. You know, my mother calls constantly with all her stories of what's going on with her friends and the family gossip. And of course, you know, my living room is like a nonstop hotel for visiting relatives and friends and things like that. So even though I've been away from Asia for the greater part of my life, these people are still in and out of my lives and in and out of my orbits. And I think being away actually has sort of amplified my ability to see it for what it is. Because in my normal life, I'm removed from all this.
Of course.
You know,
yeah.
I have a very normal New York life of someone working in the media profession. But when these people come over or when I go to Asia and I see it, it's such a high contrast to what my life is like. And to see the nuances and the dramas and the scandals and the things that these people really, really fret about on a daily basis that are so removed from my reality is, to me, the comedy of the books.
Well, you raise a point, actually, that's interesting as a sort of to Western readers, is this notion of family. It's like a rotating soap opera, all of these characters. It's hard to even keep up with all of the intersections. But at the same time, there's great comfort in that. There's this people, you know, there's a sense of interconnectivity that we in, you know, small Western families are losing sight of. So there's that aspect, too, which I think is almost a counterbalance to the, you know, materialistic kind of orbit that provides almost heart and soul to the book.
Well, that's a nice way to put it. You want to trade families? No, but it is interesting. Yes, there is this continuity and there is this sort of, you feel very rooted in something that goes way beyond you. You know, like I looked at my family tree a few days ago, just as I was doing research to begin the whole process of interviews, and my family tree goes back to 964 AD. You know, all the ancestors, what they did, you know, their roles in the family. And it's daunting, really.
But it's also a root.
That much. Yes. And at the same time, it's very self-galvanizing, too. So, but it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
Okay, I want to ask you about some of the excesses that are such a voyeuristic treat. In the wedding that I mentioned at the top, there was Cirque du Soleil and the Vienna Boys Choir. And I read an interview you gave once, I think shortly after the book was published, you said that your editor didn't allow you to keep some of the details in because they said nobody would believe them. What kind of things were you leaving out if that's what you included?
It was becoming way too over the top. You know, just sort of the food spectacle and the performance spectacle and the flying people over on private planes and helicopters and, you know, the use of all these modes of transportation was getting to her. There was one too many private plane. And I explained that, you know, even when my book came out, it was already old hat. A $40 million wedding was eclipsed, you know, in 2013 by a $120 million wedding that took place, you know, started in Hong Kong, went to Sydney. I mean, it just boggles the mind. So this was a very quaint wedding by comparison.
Well, is there anything that shocks you? Are you shockable?
I'm shocked all the time.
For example?
Every time I go to Asia, I'm constantly shocked. You know, just the way in which money to some of these people is spent so freely and to such an extent that, you know, it's money that I can't even fathom making in my entire lifetime that they would spend on a weekend of shopping in Paris. And that's parodied in my new book. You know, there's a group of people that go on a grand shopping spree tour of Paris. And I've actually seen things very close to what I describe in the book. And it's just, it boggles the mind that it actually happens, that people would pay this much for so little.
But Asia is, as you say, China is driving the luxury market. That has become a standard. I wonder to what extent your book is almost read not as satire, but as how-to.
As a manual.
As a manual.
I really hope not, but you never know. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how truth begins to imitate fiction.
Now, while there's lots of Chloe and Alexander McQueen, et cetera, and Hermes Birkin bags and so forth, there's also a lot of food in your book, and it's almost a character in and of itself. I get the sense that there's more sensual delight in eating almost than in sex. In fact, there's more eating in the book than there is sex. Tell me about the kind of the intersections of status and pleasure that food provides.
You know, it's interesting because food is the one thing that cuts across every different class and social background in China. No matter how rich or how poor you are, there is an emphasis on eating as well as you possibly can. And of course, for the crazy rich and for the China rich, you know, they've taken this to the nth degree. They're eating foods of such, you know, it's a combination of ostentation and finding the rarest animals you can possibly eat, for example. And it's, you know, it's actually a real problem in a way, because they're consuming, in many cases in China now, a lot of very endangered species are going into these recipes because they believe that it will provide prosperity or virility or have some sort of health benefit.
Because it is an endangered
exactly.
species?
Exactly. Tiger bone wine, for example, is a
you
very,
mentioned that.
Is a cult wine product that actually, you know, uses the bones of tigers. You know, and of course, rhinoceros horn has just been, you know, really decimated the rhinoceros population in around the world. So, you know, it's amazing how food, especially for the crazy rich, has become such a status symbol. And for the mainland Chinese, so much of them, they're eating just to prove they can eat it. Do they really enjoy what they're eating? No one really knows. But they have to say, we have this dish and we're going to eat it and we're going to spend $800 on this one dish right now.
A countercurrent to that, though, is also this kind of snobby quest for authenticity, of knowing exactly where to go. And that's not necessarily the latest three-star, you know.
Yeah, that's a very Singaporean thing.
Oh, is
I think
it,
for Singaporeans, you know, Singaporeans being a much, the, you know, the culture of money has existed for many more generations mm-hmm. in Singapore. And so right now, you know, Singapore, I think, is the original foodie country. Because it's an island where four cultures have clashed, you know, the Chinese, the Malay, the Indian, and the European, mm-hmm. which has created this beautiful, beautiful sort of cuisine, the stew of cuisines that, you know, and so being this island of such infinite variety, you know, people, the bragging rights are about where to find the very, very best chicken rice or the very best
exactly.
satay or the very best chili crab. And
right.
everyone's always trying to challenge someone else. And now that they've become also so rich, it's people jet set to eat around the world. And it's interesting to see that so many of the best Chinese restaurants in the world are actually not in Asia anymore. They're in London. They're in Vancouver.
Yes.
You know, places like that. And these people will fly around the world just to have roast duck in London.
Or a specific dish.
Exactly.
You write about.
Yeah, lobster noodles, you know, at Mandarin Kitchen.
Exactly. So have you had feedback from the echelons you skewer, profile, report on?
I have.
And what
I
has
have.
That been like?
You know, I think you really only hear the positive. If there's negative coming, I think most people, you know, are too polite to say anything.
Really?
It. Yeah.
Okay.
I really haven't heard a negative comment, knock on wood, so far.
Right.
But I've received, you know, letters, fan mail, and, you know, personal people have reached out on behalf of people for me. And it's interesting to see a lot of the younger generation of these sort of very upper echelon families, they really appreciate the book because, as one writer who wrote and said, you know, one fan, she said, you know, you've really helped me understand my family. I thought I was in the middle of bizarro world. And I don't feel so alone anymore, knowing that you've captured my family. You know, and I didn't literally capture her family, but I captured a family like hers that has the same modes of behavior, the same mores. And so she took comfort in the fact that, you know, now she understands her family only after reading Crazy Rich Asians.
That's amazing. So I understand. Now, Crazy Rich Asians is about to be made into a movie, which isn't surprising. I'm just curious, though. It's interesting because Hollywood has been in full court press trying to appeal to the Chinese market, which is, you know, this huge, vast, prosperous market. But given Hollywood's tendency to cast white, how can you be sure, you know, Emma Stone isn't going to be playing Rachel Chu? Are you involved in this?
I am. I'm involved. I'm an executive producer of the movie. And I really chose this team. I chose to work with Colorforce and Ivanhoe Studios mm-hmm. because they were very specifically committing to telling a story that was really true to what I wrote. And I think it would defeat the purpose to cast Reese Witherspoon, as much as I love her, or Emma Stone, you know, in a movie of this sort.
I was being a bit facetious, but yeah. I think that this speaks to, I mean, the making of this movie and the requirement to make an authentic movie cast authentically is also a bit of a benchmark.
Absolutely. And I keep warning the producers. It's like, you know, you're going to be watched and so intensely sort of monitored for who's going to be in this movie, what's going to happen, and how this movie represents Asia. You know, there will be 2 billion people
really kind of
seeing what happens with this movie, because I think it's going to be a very, you know, important touchstone for what happens
in
the future.
One of the things the book does do and open up is you realize how solipsistic the Western entertainment world is, because you write about, as I say, an alternate universe in terms of megastars, and many of whom are unknown names in North America.
Completely unknown in North America, but they have huge, huge, you know, fan bases. You know, Fan Bingbing, who is the biggest star in China. The Met Ball, you know, the Met Costume Institute Ball took place, what was it, a month ago. And it was so funny to see that in the Western media, there were so many pictures of Rihanna and Kim Kardashian and people like that walking the red carpet. And there was one tiny photograph of her in a grouping of other Chinese people that had come to attend this Met Ball that was dedicated to China
with
and the history of Chinese fashion.
Exactly.
And I was like, you know, her star power in Asia eclipses all these people put together. You know, she has 500 million fans, you know, in China that follow her every move.
Well, and her costume was actually probably
stunning.
The best of the night.
Yeah, I thought so.
Absolutely. Now, what is the timeline on the movie? Any sense?
They're really purposefully hoping to really move it along as fast as possible. You know, we're almost done with the script, and then we can start casting very soon and hopefully go into production early next year.
Now, you've created this universe now with these two books. Are we going to be able to look forward to a sequel for China Rich Girlfriend?
I hope so. I mean, I'd always planned it as a trilogy. So I really hope I get to finish the story of this clan, at least in the third book. But it's going to really depend on readers and whether they want a third book and whether book two does well enough to warrant that.
Well, I think that after having read it myself, I can imagine that you're going to have much problem. Anyone who loved the first book is going to love the second one.
Thank you. I'm going to cross my fingers.
Okay. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was Kevin Kwan, author of Crazy Rich Asians and its sequel, China Rich Girlfriend. You've been listening to an abbreviated edition of the Bibliopod for the weekend of June 26th. Please join us next time. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian. Theme music is by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. Thanks to Anne Lavray and Scott Metcalf.